All right, Jules, we promised it to our audience, and here she is to discuss a bit of women's football and what it's going to look like. It's Julie Foudy.
This is going to get confusing, the two Jules.
You're right. We never had another guest called Jules, so that's first time.
I like when you said, okay, Jules, I was like, let's go. And then you were talking to that Jules.
All right, Julie, we screwed around and we joked around at the top of the show, but there's legitimate concerns here. Before we came on, you said you were worried. Now, obviously, the whole sport is being hit very, very hard by this. There's a sense, certainly, I think in Europe, at some of the big clubs, like they have spent a lot of money, Lyon, Chelsea, Manchester City, that they were big supporters of it, and they said, you know what, we don't mind maybe losing a little bit of money. We don't view it as we're losing money. We're viewing it as if we're investing money. It's like extra marketing for us. It's something, if you take the cynical view, it's something we believe in. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows, though, that when there's cutbacks, the marketing budget is the first one to go.
Yeah, and I think that's the worry for so many, right, is and we have, I mean, I think for us in the women's soccer world, we're always operating in the margins. And even though we'd like to think that things are different now and we're on, you know, this tipping point of really tapping into a market that hasn't been tapped into in terms of commercial viability and sponsorship and viewership and all these things that are great indicators of where the game could go, but we're still not there. Right. And especially when you look at, I think the biggest driver for women's soccer has been from the big clubs. I thought FIFA was going to be that driver. But I think you could argue that really the change has happened when some of the clubs you mentioned, GAB, and I mean, we can go down the list of Manchester United finally adding a club, Real Madrid, right? Barcelona, Juventus. So you're seeing now all the major clubs around the world have gotten behind women's soccer. And I think that has accelerated the growth of the game in so many great ways. And so that's my, and I know I'm not alone in this concern. That's my biggest concern going forward is it's just, you know, that $2 million that before the pandemic was a drop in the bucket, or you could rationalize and, you know, that loss in so many different ways because there was a market there that eventually would come around. Now people are very worried about whether it's going to be, you know, a 5-year, 10-year build. And so they may just take that away entirely.
I wanted to ask about that because I know there's been a little bit of debate because when a lot of these big football clubs started adding women's teams, you know, in some countries, certainly in Europe, and obviously the NWSL has followed its own models, you had independent women's teams that were playing to a very high level. And then all of a sudden, you know, these teams that were founded as women's teams and had tried to grow organically as women's teams, all of a sudden they found themselves competing against Manchester City and Barcelona and Juventus and whatnot. A lot of them struggled. A lot of them ran into difficulties. Is there a sense or is an argument to be made that maybe the model for the women's game shouldn't be aligning itself with, you know, what are ultimately men's teams, where the men's team will always be the priority, and kind of trying to grow independently of that, or do the drawbacks outweigh the benefits?
Well, I think there will come a time when there is an argument to make in that regard, but I don't think we're there. I mean, if you just look at the amount of people willing to, with deep pockets, invest in the women's game to this day, even given how we thought that really things were changing and the climate was changing. And as we've talked about, and especially with the numbers you saw around the Women's World Cup in 2019, viewership and commercial engagement and all these things that you hadn't seen in past Women's World Cups, perhaps. But you're still not seeing at the league level. You're not seeing, you know, big, deep-pocketed, independent investors stepping forward and supporting the game. And so although it's a great argument to make, I don't think it's a realistic one, given the climate and given that there's still not an appetite to put big dollars behind the women's game from those who have the big dollars, unless it comes from the men's side. And I would also argue, and mind you, back in the day when MLS was launching and our first women's pro league, WUSA, was launching. I was very against linking with MLS because I just didn't feel like they cared about the women's league. They cared about the growth of the women's league. And I don't think they did because they were so locked in on the minutia of their everyday. It's like you can't get your head out of the sand when you're just trying to survive as a new league. And so they couldn't take that on. But you're seeing a lot of other men's teams now, and of course MLS teams who have been around for 20 years, who are able to look up and see that there's value in adding a different market. There's value in getting more games in a similar stadium or the same stadium. There's value in sharing staff and infrastructure and all those things, which we know cost so much money. So I actually do like when these big super clubs are saying, yeah, let's add a women's side, because it's often a different market they're tapping into as well. And it's a new market, an untapped market. And so I think there's a lot of upside for these clubs and there's a lot of security for the women.
What would you like to see, Julie, in the next few weeks? Now, we've talked about FIFA having a big fund to give to the federations or the confederations and stuff like that. Would you like to see MLS maybe helping the NWSL, or at least the club that need it, same in Europe, UEFA helping the women's team that need it? What do you think is the way forward to try to protect the game with this pandemic?
Well, I don't know if you guys saw that FIFA report on the women's game, which said it was a lot of doom and gloom of, you know, this is an existential threat to the women's game. And one of the things they recommended is making sure that in these budget cuts and in these, this restructuring, which is going to naturally happen, is to pay attention to what you're doing with your women's side and to, emphasize and make sure that they're keeping some funding for the women's side as well. And I know with, you know, for FIFA and the international game, that was a huge one in terms of prioritizing the international windows in the international game. And we've seen, you know, now a lot of this growth on the women's side has come from these super clubs. And I think it's an excellent time for FIFA to say, okay, now we're going to step forward and show why the women's game is important and why we should be funding it and maybe helping member associations out or incentivizing them to actually hold competitions and international competitions. Because we know with the visibility of the World Cup and the Olympics, the two main events for women's soccer, then of course you're also, it's trickling down to the leagues and those players, and it's just generating enthusiasm and awareness that I think helps them from a marketing standpoint as well. So I think beyond obviously what the leagues can do, I'm super hopeful that we see the member associations all over, and FIFA in particular, incentivizing them to actually step up in this crisis right now for women's soccer and support them in ways, be it, you know, competitions, friendlies. But I know that's a tall ask as well, given the times.
It's funny because I spoke to them, about that. And you'll remember that they had set apart $500 million out of their reserves to be spent over the next 4 years to promote the women's game. And this is in addition to, they're also going to looking at creating some big fund to sort of help all, you know, the entire game everywhere and people who need it. I know there's one argument which I think caused some consternation. I think after the Women's World Cup, there was an argument at the World Cup about, you know, equal prize money and whatnot. One point that some people make, and I'd love to get your take on this, is that fundamentally, if you're talking about something like equal prize money at a World Cup, you're talking about the richest federations in the world, because those are the ones that end up doing very well at the World Cup. Those are the ones that have the most women players. I think it's something like 45% of the world's registered women footballers are in the U.S., for example. In fact, I think 7 of the 8 countries with the most women footballers reach the quarterfinals of the World Cup. So there's a direct correlation. You get more women playing, then teams tend to do better. And they made the point that one of the difficulties is if you increase prize money even further at the World Cup, yeah, you're rewarding federations like the US and Germany and Australia and England that are already wealthy, and you're not doing much to grow the game elsewhere. And those funds would be better served making sure that women who want to play everywhere in the world, which is also FIFA's whole mission, have a chance to play. I'm interpreting from your nod that you're slightly skeptical about that argument.
I am a little skeptical because I mean, why not do both? Right. I think you heard Megan Rapinoe in her press conference before the final or the semifinal, when asked about this. And she said, you know, look, it's not that it needs to be equal, the prize money. We get that there's clearly a different market for the men's side of the World Cup versus the women. And there's different revenue clearly coming in. But you also can't have it where in 4 years' time, actually from 2015 to 2019 for the women, that gap actually got larger because they're paying the men that much more than they've increased the women. So the gap between the two is actually growing rather than diminishing. And I think that is something that frustrates the women mightily. And she even said in that press conference, I'm not asking it to be even, but gosh, there has to be strides we're making here, right, for the women's game. But I think part of the frustration too with so many players, past and present, is that they don't see any type of prioritization in terms of FIFA two member associations and trying to incentivize them to use that money or to spend that money or to invest in the women's game. If it comes from FIFA to say that you have to make this a priority and we're going to incentivize you to make it a priority. And again, people will say, well, they're not bringing in the money, but this is a national governing body. This is different than a league where you're looking at revenue. FIFA's mission is to grow the game and to grow the game for all, right? So they have to be putting funding into growing the game and creating opportunities for girls. And unless they're doing programming at the national level, which so few are doing on a consistent basis, then you can continue to see that it's just a handful of teams that are the successful ones on the women's side.
I wanted to ask you about the legal battle of the U.S. women team and the federation with the salaries with the men and everything. Where are we at in that legal battle?
That's a good question, Jules. I mean, what we do know, of course, is with all the turmoil that happened in March with the federation, from them filing that 2,600-page brief that essentially created such an uproar because it didn't just argue that women are inherently different. They're inherently inferior. And so it's a different job. And there was a sponsor backlash as well. So, you saw Carlos Cordero, the president of U.S. Soccer, resign, Cindy Parlow-Cohn taking, and assuming that voluntary, I will stress, position, which is, doing the work of probably five people in a voluntary role, which is ridiculous in itself. And then they hired finally a CEO in Will Wilson. So you have all this change, all this turnover. They just laid off 15% of their staff, or about 15% of their staff, canceled the Development Academy. So clearly they're showing signs of strain, given the pandemic, given there's no games, given that they're sitting on, I think, six different lawsuits right now, which is their own doing in large part, right? So I think if any silver lining can come out of this, it's that you have in Cindy Parlow, a player who is a woman who has lived it by playing on the national team for many years. I mean, from our battles in the 90s and the 2000s, she's lived that, right? She understands the frustration of these players and she can say to them, I hear you. I get your frustration, right? But let's do what works best for soccer in this country. Let's do and pay you guys more clearly. And let's figure this out for all parties. So I'm hopeful that they can get to some type of settlement, but I haven't heard there's been much movement, honestly.
Julie, there's an argument that some people have made is that maybe the women's game shouldn't necessarily follow the model of the men's game in terms of generating revenue. Obviously the club structure is the basis of the men's game, but you look at other sports, I'm thinking of rugby and cricket in particular, where it's not the club game, it's the internationals that drive all the revenue. Okay. You still have a club game, you still have leagues, but it's a lot less in terms of importance, in terms of revenue, in terms of facilities. Mm-hmm. And there's a trickle down effect is that a model, or should we stick to the club model and have the best possible professional league and only wheel out the national teams for big competitions?
No, I mean, I think it is actually a good idea, given that, you know, the women's game follows more the model like you were discussing with rugby and cricket, where the international games and the most visibility you're seeing on the women's side is happening at the international level. It's happening at the Olympics. It's happening at World Cups. And I mean, a good reminder, the Olympics for the women aren't an under 23 event, right? For, as they are for the men, in large part, it's a full senior women's event. So it carries the same magnitude of importance to the women as a World Cup. And I know there's been a lot of arguments now too, that because we've shown that there is some commercial viability in the women's side of the game, right? And possibly some longevity on the women's side of the game commercially. And to your point, Gab, that there were over 1 billion viewers for the first time. And you're seeing rises in viewership, not just in America, which we know has always been good during a World Cup, but all over the place. Italy's numbers were huge. Brazil's numbers were huge. Spain set, you know, set records. So I think there is an argument to say, like, let's figure out what the value is by separating the two. And then also being able to figure out what the corporate value is. A lot of these guys buy in on the corporate side and the sponsorship side, and they weren't activating.
For those who aren't marketing mavens like the rest of us, not experts in sponsorship,
yeah.
When you say that these sponsors bought in but didn't activate, what do you mean?
Yeah, sorry. Meaning that they're not running ads during the World Cup. They're not in store with, you know, Secret had 6 different deodorants with the players' names and likenesses on all their different deodorants this past World Cup. We haven't seen that in the past World Cup. They'd activate on the men's side and do all these promotions around the men, but they would go silent come the women's World Cup, which does no good to the women because you're not getting the exposure. So there was an argument too that if you separated out how much money they were bringing in on the corporate side and then also incentivizing these corporations to activate on the women's side, which they now are, then you could also generate more income that way. So I don't mind separating out those two, right, and seeing what the value is. Because right now when they get pushed into the same pot as they do with U.S. soccer, you never understand what the value is on either side.
This is something that I didn't fully understand, and I have to confess, to prep for this, I spoke to some people who cover women's football. So I don't know if everybody realizes this outside of sort of women's soccer enthusiasts, that the NWSL, and correct me if I'm wrong, is actually in part bankrolled and organized by the USSF.
Correct, so, U.S. soccer.
Yes, by U.S. soccer. And so a lot of the women who are on the national team who are taking this legal action against U.S. soccer are also employed by NWSL teams, which, you know, it just seems like an initial conflict of interest. But what I don't get, and this point was made to me, is that the way NWSL markets itself locally, right, they decided to keep playing, for example, during the Women's World Cup. Mm-hmm. And that totally blew me away. Right? You have people complaining. They're playing the Copa America during the Women's World Cup. They're playing the freaking NWSL during the Women's World Cup. I mean, isn't that a question for U.S. soccer? How much do you value NWSL or indeed the women's national team at the World Cup that you're playing them at the same time? And then on top of that, a lot of the marketing was like, oh, go watch this team so you can go see Julie Ertz. But then she's not there because she's on tour with the U.S. national team at the same time that her club team is playing.
Well, and then on top of that, they have this victory tour in their contract. I don't know if that's what you were referencing.
Yes.
When you're talking about them being away, but you know, they win and then you think they've been gone a month. You think you're going to get them back to your club. And no, now they got to go play 5 more games in a victory tour that honestly, you know, they of course want to, you know, share this love of winning with their fans, but they also feel bad because they're leaving their club teams again. But the history of that, Gab, is that that was in the contract with our CBA or collective bargaining agreement for many years. And back in the day before we had club teams, and before we had a second source of income from professional league, we put that in there so that we could actually have games to make money as players. And so that's why it's still in there. It used to actually be 10 games and they were like, this is insane. We can't play 10 games anymore. So they've knocked it down to 5. The players make a ton of money doing those 5 games because they pay them that money. And they get the revenue as well, of course, U.S. Soccer with the gate. But yeah, that needs to be looked at because.
Yeah, but sorry, but the clubs and the average players who aren't good enough to be on the national team and who make, I mean, I saw what the average wage in the NWSL is. Those guys make a pittance and they make even less money because they get lower gates because everybody's watching the victory tour and not watching their club.
Yeah, I know. And it makes no sense. They're going to have to address that. I completely agree because your priority too should be funneling all your energy and all your marketing and all your attention on this club that's going to hopefully get a bounce, right, off of the you know increased viewership and interest around the World Cup, and you're slicing away at that.
Gabby's all about the marketing and the business model, and is that the right business model? I'm more about what's happening on the pitch, Julie, to be honest. like the fact that Olympique Lyonnais thought it was a good idea to go and invest in Rennes FC, which is a very good team in the NWSL. I think Tony Parker was involved as well, and Jean-Michel Aulas was very proud of himself, I thought, which is good. And I'm curious to see how this is going to work, that dynamic, because then maybe that could give an idea to people at Manchester City, who already are doing it for the men's team, where they buy other clubs in other continent and stuff like that. So I think, again, I like the idea and I would like to have your opinion about that. And also, I think this week, Sarah Bouadi, the Lyon goalkeeper, and obviously Jennifer Marozan, the number 10, have signed for Utah, which still shows that the NWSL is not just still the biggest league in the world, but also still attracts the best from Europe, or at least some of the best of Europe, and still have that very attractive part of, it's still, like when I was growing up, Marielle Pichon went to play with you in the US because it was it was heaven for her, you know, and still now you could see the attraction still being there.
Yeah, Pichon. Oh my gosh, let's spend a podcast on her.
Oh yeah,
she's a legend. I love that woman. She was amazing. Too. She is so good. Getting Bouhadi and Marozan this week actually was great news for the NWSL because I think the biggest challenge for them going forward after this Olympics. Well, having said that, Olympics were supposed to be, of course, this summer, right? Mm-hmm. And that gives then, in the women's game, you do World Cup and the Olympics the next year, and then you get the 2.5-3 year gap. And I was very concerned you were going to have a lot of players, big U.S. stars, going overseas because the market would pay more to go overseas, right? And so your NWSL was going to be depleted. And then further decentivizing players internationally, international players to come play in the NWSL because it's not the best league. So I thought that was a great signing because those are two of the best. And we know Marozan can also just do amazing things and hopefully bring more Germans over, which we haven't honestly seen that many of compared to our days with WSA. Yeah. And I think, you know, there has been talks for years of Barcelona wanting to also start a women's team. Very similar, right, to Lyon and what they're doing with Rennes and joining with another team. I think all those things are excellent because they're big global iconic brands that can bring players, that can bring additional funds, that can bring marketing. And so I do hope that we see more of that. I do hope we see more partnership with MLS teams that make sense because we've seen how successful it's worked with MLS with Portland, and Merritt Paulson's group. And so I think, all of that is very good. You know, it gets complicated when you have these big brands coming over into the ownership group. But I also think, it pushes us domestically to think bigger.
Julie, Jules is going to hate me, but I'm going to bring it back to business and marketing. I was intrigued by what you mentioned there because obviously we have Lyon, right? Big European soccer brand buying into, you know, directly into NWSL. You mentioned Barcelona as a possibility. We saw a little bit of this years ago in MLS, obviously, with the Red Bull, New York City, Chivas for a while they were around. I kind of feel that didn't really work out in terms of the synergy between the two teams because with all due respect to MLS, the gap between Manchester City and MLS is enormous, frankly. But if big European brands with strong European women's team were to partner up or even buy in directly in the NWSL, that wouldn't be the case. In many cases, they'd be moving up in terms of competition. So I'm asking myself, as you and Jules are talking there, like, man, like, there could be something in this, right?
Yeah. And it's a demo that's super attractive. I mean, you look at the numbers, it's families, it's kids, right? It's high income, high net worth, probably, not probably, in a majority of a sense, in that it's a great market to get to. So, yes, I think that's all playing out in terms of how they're looking at things. I mean, they're thinking exactly as you are, Gab, I would imagine, in terms of, okay, one, we're getting into a super popular market in America in the women's game. They know how popular women's soccer is here too. And also into a consumer and a potential customer that's going to consume more than just women's soccer in the United States, but our brand globally as well.
I want to ask you, because I've heard stories again from women's players over here and the conditions that they're in. A lot of the women who play in the Women's Premier League over here, you know, a lot of the foreign players especially, they're away from home. A lot of them might be stuck in small apartments. They live somewhere else and during the off season. All of a sudden, they're on lockdown. You know, these aren't people that have big back gardens. They don't have a golf course at home like Gareth Bale does. It's objectively difficult for them to go and train. Some of them have gone home. Do you know where Sam Kerr is?
Yeah, I think she's back home.
She's in Australia?
I think she's back home.
The person I spoke to had no idea. So even if she were to come back, then she gets another 2 weeks of quarantine. I mean, it's crazy. It's got to – you talk to these athletes, but it's got to be really difficult for them to maintain any kind of fitness if you're in a one-bedroom apartment. I mean, what do you do?
I know. I don't know if you saw on ESPN the horse competition. Did you see that for the NBA versus the WNBA? I mean, my takeaway from all of that was like, I mean, look at the courts of the NBA players in their backyard compared to, like, you know, the WNBA players, like, fighting all the elements. Tamika Catchings is, like, shooting on this rim with the wind blowing. And I forget who she was going up against, but this NBA player had this, like, gym, like, full-size gym that was in his house. I was like, are you kidding me? So, yes, it's exactly like that for women's soccer players. And it's hard. It's hard for a lot of them. I mean, they're barely making it to begin with. And mind you, there have been strides in terms of pay and contracts and professionalizing the sport for women. But still so many and the large majority exist in the margins of they're just happy if they're breaking even, right? If their housing is paid for, they get some food and maybe they get some insurance. And so to try and maintain that fitness and sanity during this is tough. It's a tough slog for them. And I'm happy when you see that, you know, Sam Kerr has been allowed to go back to Australia. I mean, the first thing she commented about is, oh my God, it's 21 degrees Celsius and now I'm dying. It's so, you know, who would have thought 21 degrees Celsius was hot, but now after being in England, I'm dying. But just to be around family too, and to have a little bit of consistency there for them to hopefully have some space to train as well. So, but yeah, it's a tough slog. It's very different than, and I'm not trying to minimize what the men have to go through in terms of training, but it's very different when your means are very different.
All right, Julie, thanks so much. Jules, you want more Julie time?
I mean, we could keep you for another hour, Julie, but you've got better things to do than talking to us. Thank you so much for all your time.
No, thank you guys for making this a topic of your podcast, because I do think it's a conversation we need to be having about how we come out of this stronger and together for all of football. So thanks for doing that, you guys.